from WBUR Boston. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Super Committee announced last night that it failed to come up with $1.2 trillion in savings over the next 10 years. It's another black eye for bipartisanship in Washington and raises yet again the question of whether America is capable of getting its fiscal house in order. This hour on Point, the Super Committee fails. We look at what's next. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the Super Committee's failure? Who do you blame? The Republicans? The Democrats? Both? You can comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me now from Washington is John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and political writer for The New York Times. Welcome back to On Point, John.
Hi, Jackie.
We were last here in August when this had all coming down. So as a refresher, please, what was the mandate of the Super Committee in case someone is unclear about that?
The so-called Super Committee, and I hope we can stop calling it that now that we've seen the spectacular failure of the committee, was to come up with $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction, spending cuts, tax increases, some combination of those two over 10 years. Remember, the president and House Speaker, John Boehner, and President Obama had been engaged in talks on a so-called grand bargain for a large deal. They were trying to get $4 trillion over 10 years. They couldn't do that. They settled on a smaller amount. They had budget cuts that were enacted this summer of $1.2 trillion, and they told the committee to do another $1.2. And the hope was that these 12 members, six Democrats, six Republicans, would somehow be able to sit down, break through, create a deal that would then go to Congress for an up or down vote, no amendments, and get a big piece of the rest of the job done. They were unable to do that because the differences over what the size and shape of government should be, particularly those big entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what should be the level of taxation to pay for them, specifically whether the wealthy should pay more than they do under the current system, and if so, how. They could not bridge that gap. They conceded defeat yesterday, and now we take it, both parties will take it to the voters in the 2012 elections.
Let's play a few clips that have been occurring in recent days to talk about that philosophical divide that you just mentioned. On Sunday, on Meet the Press, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, who, of course, was on the, I still have to call it the Super Committee, spoke about what he saw as the reasons that a decision could not be reached.
The calculation politically has been made by many that they think they're going to win the Senate, win the presidency, and they want to wait until next year and just write their own deal. And the second and most significant block to our doing something right now, tomorrow, is their insistence on the Grover-Norquist pledge and extending the Bush tax cuts. Now, we are not a tax-cutting committee. We're a deficit reduction committee.
And, of course, Grover Norquist is the one who has charged Republicans with not raising taxes. Let's go to the other side. In New Hampshire on Sunday, former Massachusetts governor and GOP candidate Mitt Romney said that President Obama should have done more.
He's done nothing. It is another example of failed leadership. He has not taken personal responsibility.
And the president did stay out of the fray this time, John. Why do you think he did?
He stayed out of the fray because he had already exerted the maximum amount of leverage that was available to him. Those direct talks, one-on-one, with a willing partner, John Boehner, the House Speaker, that was his moment to try to shape this outcome in a decisive way. And what happened was that John Boehner found that he was not able to bring along members of the House Republican caucus in a deal that would raise taxes. And that is was the Democratic members' minimum requirement for a deal that would cut those entitlement programs. Because he couldn't do that, those grand bargain talks collapsed. And the idea that the president was going to be able to influence the super committee was never viable. He stayed out of it. He does have a political strategy in 2012 of running against the Congress, specifically Republicans in Congress, but there is no reason to expect that the president could exert influence over the super committee in ways that he couldn't do it with John Boehner one-on-one.
You know, it seemed back in August, John, that this was going to be so scary if this committee failed with this word automatic sequestration that would cut from defense and other programs, that was going to loom so large that the committee would have to act. And it had a lot of power to do that. It only needed 51 votes to pass. So what do you think this says about the failure of Congress to get things done?
Well, one thing that we need to keep in mind is that the president and the Republican leaders who made the deal to create the super committee left themselves a bit of an escape valve. And the escape valve was the fact that these automatic cuts, which are indeed things that nobody wants to happen, cuts in defense automatically of a level that the administration, the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, says would not be good for the security of the United States, and also automatic cuts in education, health care, other domestic programs. They don't take effect for a year. So what that means is two things. One, Congress will have opportunity over the coming months to come up with an alternative deal, achieve the deficit reduction itself. And B, the two parties are going to fight about this in the 2012 elections and hope that voters speak with a reasonably clear voice. If they do that, after the election, you could see a lame duck session of Congress, action at that time to stave off the cuts, which don't take effect till 2013. So that's a bit of a shock absorber for the system to allow politics to play out a little bit more.
All right. Thank you. Joining me now from San Francisco is Tim Dickinson, political correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine and author of RollingStone.com's political blog, National Affairs Daily. His November 9th article for the magazine is called How the GOP Became the Party of the Rich. Welcome, Tim Dickinson.
Hi, Jackie.
So, Tim, I'm sure, like all of us, you were looking at this over the weekend. What's your take?
The collapse of this sort of seemed preordained by the way the Republicans stacked their committee and the way the Democrats stacked their side of the committee. The Democrats had a lot of deal cutters, Max Baucus, among others, and the Republicans had a bunch of essentially hardline anti-revenue folks. And I think you saw that in the progression of the ratio between revenue and spending cuts that were being discussed as this went along. So the grand bargain, well, even if you take the Alan Simpson plan, that was 1 to 1 in terms of revenue and spending cuts. The grand bargain, I think, was 4 to 1 in terms of revenue and spending cuts. And then by the time the super committee was talking, it was a 1 to 1 ratio. So this kept going further and further to the right and was not only talking about extending the Bush tax cuts, but then lowering the rates for the wealthiest again on top of this. So this was going to heap trillions of new dollars onto the deficit through reduced revenues in the future. It sort of became a comical kabuki theater, sort of more definitionally about what the parties are about than actually a serious proposal.
Tim, do you see any kind of silver lining here? I mean, we have had pundits on the left and right in recent days saying that maybe the best thing that could be done is inaction.
I mean, certainly this was not a good deal for anyone left of the far right to sign on to. I mean, the fact that this was going to essentially eat up all of the available tax expenditures and pay down a new lower tax rate, marginal rate for the highest earners, as well as extend the Bush tax cuts at expense of $5.6 trillion over the next decade. And I think the Republicans were ultimately offering about $300 billion in new revenues to pay for that. It just didn't make any sense. And so I think John is absolutely right that you're likely to see either through the budget process, which is not this super committee gimmick, there's a normal process through which these things are supposed to be debated, and we may get and that calls for more consensus, and we may, if people are serious about passing a budget, we may see some progress there, or in a lame duck session, as John suggested after the election, I think you're going to be able to see people make more innovative moves.
John, is it fair to say that people were not really paying attention to this until now, and are they going to be assigning more blame to one party than another?
if you mean average voters, I would say that people were not paying close attention to this. And my suspicion is that their general mood is going to be one of disgust and feeling as if the Congress is inept, even to a greater extent than they had said before. Can't get much lower. The ratings for Congress are right around 10%, give or take a couple of points. And that's one of the elements that goes into the president's calculation that he can run against the Congress. Now, as the incumbent in chief for the entire government, the president will take some fallout for the perception that Washington doesn't work, but he's counting on being able to frame it more sharply. And we saw that immediately after the supercommittee announced its failure. He went hard in his press conference immediately after that at the Republicans, their refusal to consider higher levels of revenue. And he's going to try to turn that into an argument against the Republican Congress and try to channel voters' disgust with Washington in that direction.
A risky strategy, do you think?
Not really. It's actually has lower risk, I think, than anything else that's available to him. Remember, he's running for re-election, Jackie, in a terrible economy, 9% unemployment, very slow growth, and the options for trying to define himself and sell an argument for why he gets another 4 years, they're not great. And okay, so he's got to find a way to direct public anger.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the failure of the so-called supercommittee and what comes next. And we're speaking with John Harwood. He's the chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and political writer for The New York Times. And with Tim Dickinson, political correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine and author of RollingStone.com's political blog, National Affairs Daily. His November 9th article for the magazine was called How the GOP Became the Party of the Rich. And we certainly want to take your calls and comments. And let's go to a couple which came into our website here from Patrick. He says, one of our political parties has gone on strike. President Obama has hopefully realized that his only position of strength is to let the Republicans strike and then saddle them with the responsibility for the government's impotence. He needs to point out as loudly and frequently as possible that the Republicans own this gridlock. Here's one in from Aaron Miller. It just seems like the supercommittee was yet another political device to kick the can a little further down the road. Did anyone actually expect anything would come of this endeavor except for more of the same? Well, we were speaking just a little earlier about what President Obama said just after the decision yesterday. He vowed to veto any effort to undo these spending cuts set to take effect in 2013. He said the option is for Congress to find a compromise.
The only way these spending cuts will not take place is if Congress gets back to work and agrees on a balanced plan to reduce the deficit by at least $1.2 trillion. That's exactly what they need to do.
Tim, you've written a 20-page article on tax cuts and the Republican Party. Do you think that that is what the breaking point was, trying to hang on to the Bush-era tax cuts for the very wealthy?
Absolutely. I mean, the article traces since 1997 sort of the systematic way in which the Republican Party has pushed for lower tax rates on the investor class in particular and the wealthy overall. And so this has sort of become, as Ronald Reagan's former budget director described it to me, an anti-tax jihad on the behalf of the Republican Party. And so this is sort of core to the Republican brand. Grover Norquist has 98% of the Republican caucus in the House signed up to his anti-tax pledge, which also bars Republicans from closing even tax loopholes that they don't like unless that revenue is going to be steered into further reductions in marginal rates or in capital gains rates. And so this is sort of the core Republican brand now is either preserving or increasing the tax advantages of the wealthiest among us.
But let's listen to what Arizona Senator John Kyle said on Meet the Press this past Sunday. He said the Republicans offered a proposal they felt Democrats should have accepted that would have led to substantial cuts.
It adds up to about $640 billion that we could actually save in increased costs or in some cases derive some revenue from asset sales and that sort of thing. Our Democratic friend said no to that offer because it didn't raise taxes, and I think it tells you a lot.
John Harwood, the Democrats did say no to that offer. Why?
Because the shape of the cuts that Republicans are proposing and the failure to include significant new revenue is something that they couldn't accept. Remember, they cut $1.2 trillion in the deal that the president struck with John Boehner after the large talks collapsed already. Earlier in the year, they cut a significant amount of money from domestic discretionary spending to avoid a government shutdown. And what Democrats were doing were finally drawing a line and saying, we are not going to go deeper into the services that government provides unless we're going to get some revenue on the other side. And the one thing I would add to what Tim said a moment ago is it's not just an anti-tax brand. It's also an anti-government brand. And remember, Republicans now serving in Congress are the ideological descendants of people who opposed the creation of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid in the first place. They want those programs much smaller. It's not easy to say so directly because especially in Social Security and Medicare, they're very popular programs. But we saw when Paul Ryan, the chairman of the Budget Committee, moved a budget that cut Medicare substantially, that they are committed to shrinking those programs in a way that Democrats are not willing to go along to. So the trade-off is really taxes, especially taxes on people at the top end, versus Medicare and Social Security, and that's where the rub lies between the two parties.
Joining me now in Washington is Alex Brill. He's a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also a former senior advisor and chief economist to the House Ways and Means Committee under George W. Bush. Welcome to On Point, Alex Brill.
Hi, Jackie.
Thanks for being with us. Alex, would you please give us your take on what happened yesterday and why?
Well, nothing happened yesterday, and that's the sad point. The failure of the super committee to reach a deal, I think, is a significant setback for the future of our fiscal path. We face large deficits in the near term. More concerning is we face even larger deficits, projected deficits, in the long term as entitlement spending grows faster and faster, faster than the growth rate of our overall economy. The $1.2 trillion target that the super committee had is really, unfortunately, a relatively small target given the size of the fiscal hole our country faces over the coming decades. As was discussed earlier, there had been talks about a $4 trillion deal or so-called go-big strategies. The fact that on a bipartisan basis, Congress couldn't come together and develop strategies even to address this smaller goal is quite concerning, and it shows the powerful role that politics is playing in this process over the need for sound fiscal and economic policy.
Well, Alex, you were an advisor under George W. Bush. Do you think that the Republicans on the committee played it right in your judgment? Were they right to offer what they did and hold out for what they did?
Earlier in the show, there was discussion. Tim's been discussing the role of tax policy here. I unfortunately haven't had a chance to read his article, but I will later today. I'm a big fan of his magazine. But I think that what is missing from the conversation is the fact that Republicans did offer increased revenues in the super committee debate. So we know that Senator Toomey had laid forward a proposal that included hundreds of billions of dollars of additional tax revenues. And in fact, I understand from media reports that those tax increases would come from higher income individuals. So there has been a shift, I think, in the Republican Party on the tax question. We know that in the talks leading up to the August deal between the Speaker and the President, there was discussion of additional tax revenues. What we need, however, to fundamentally address our fiscal challenges are the entitlement reforms. Those are the issues that actually lie outside of the coming decade and are much, much larger than any tax increase that anyone would contemplate.
Let me just play you a clip here by former Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson, who was co-chair of President Obama's Deficit Commission, the Simpson-Bowles Commission. He spoke before the Supercommittee on November 1st, and he warned about the influence of Grover Norquist. Let's listen to that.
If Grover Norquist is now the most powerful man in America, he should run for president. There's no question about his power, and let me tell you, he has people in thrall. That's a terrible phrase. Lincoln used it. It means your mind has been captured. You're in bondage with the soul. So here he is. I asked him, he said, my hero is Ronald Reagan. I said, well, he raised taxes 11 times in his 8 years. And he said, I don't know. I didn't like that at all. I said, well, he did it. Why do you suppose? He said, I don't know. Very disappointing. I said, probably did it to make the country run. Another sick idea.
Alex Brill, do you think that Republicans have a fundamentally different philosophy about taxes and policy now than they did when Ronald Reagan was president? You just heard Alan Simpson. And also I'd like to ask about the influence of Grover Norquist. Is he going to be seen as even more of a boogeyman than some on the left already consider him to be?
Grover Norquist has developed, I think, an amazing brand for himself. The Grover Norquist brand increases when he receives praise, and it increases when he receives criticism. And for anyone who's in the marketing world, to gain more attention in the face of good news and bad news, criticism and praise, you've developed quite a brand for yourself. And I think that. From that perspective, Grover is quite remarkable. There are a number of folks who have signed onto his pledge. There's no question, and there's no question that that pledge plays into the dynamics for members of Congress. You can find comments, including comments from the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, that are not praiseworthy towards Grover Norquist. I think the fact that Republicans.
You think he's had too much influence on the Republican Party? I mean, he's come up in the talk shows. He's come up in editorials. Do you think he's had undue influence?
I think that my concern with Grover's agenda is it fails to distinguish between good and bad tax policy. So in my work studying the tax code, I focus on which taxes are the most harmful and which taxes are the least harmful. And the Grover Norquist pledge doesn't make that, doesn't differentiate between good and bad tax policy. And so in that sense, I think that it has an undue influence on the process.
Okay, let's hear what some of our callers have to say. Michelle is calling from Newington, Georgia. Welcome to On Point, Michelle.
Hi, Jackie. How are you today?
Fine, thanks.
Great. I just wanted to mention that I really feel it's time that the American people say that we've had enough of the public employees and our different government, both parties, to be held accountable fiscally and not just fiscally responsible, but held accountable to do their jobs, to perform the public service that they're supposed to perform. If I fail to do my job and was not able to meet the needs of my company, I would be let go. I would lose my job. And yet politicians, Senate, Congress, House, are allowed to fail quite the American people often, and there's no accountability for them. And it hurts us. It hurts us as a people. And I think it hurts us both the poor and middle class. I think it hurts both Republicans and Democrats and independent voters. And I just want to know when we're going to say enough is enough. American government needs to get it together and do the right thing for the American people.
And so thank you, Michelle. And so you would like to see compromise. You would like to see the kinds of political compromises that have historically enacted legislation. But John Harwood, the way that Congress is composed right now, when Michelle talks about both sides failing to do their jobs, politicians have basically waved the white flag here. Will the voters decide in November what approach to deficit cutting they want to take? And doesn't the approach of politicians have something to do with the way that they are elected now? And that's fundamentally changed in congressional districts.
Yes, it does. But that feedback loop goes both ways. Members of Congress are reflecting the conflicting sentiments of their constituents. I want to make a couple of points about that. First of all, you were talking with Alex about Grover Norquist. I think there is too much attention lavished on Grover, who I followed for a long time in covering politics. He is a symptom rather than a cause of the sentiment within the Republican Party on taxes. Secondly, Alex is correct that Republicans did move during the negotiations in ways that I think you can look at in a glass half full way and say we are inching closer to an eventual compromise after the 2012 elections, because unlike in the grand bargain talks between the Speaker and the President, when the revenue that Speaker Boehner was talking about was what he was going to attribute to economic growth by the superior, in his view, tax policies that Republicans were recommending, in the supercommittee, they were proposing to actually raise taxes. They call it static tax increases as opposed to dynamic. I'm using some of the lingo that Alex uses in his work all the time. That meant something, and I think that Democrats have conceded the entitlement programs need to be cut, though not as much as Republicans want. Republicans have conceded taxes need to go up, though not as much as the Democrats want. And the challenge for politicians on both sides is to clarify these issues in the 2012 election so that we can get a verdict from voters, and I think that's not impossible. It's President Obama in particular, who has the bully pulpit to a greater degree than anyone else at this moment, has the high side in public opinion on some of these critical tax questions, raising taxes for the wealthy. Most Americans support that right now, but he hasn't been able to translate that into effective pressure in Congress to generate the results that he wants. That's the challenge before him right now.
All right. Let's talk to Wilbur. He's calling in from Allendale, South Carolina. Welcome to On Point, Wilbur.
Hi, Jackie. This is one of the poorest districts in South Carolina. Yet we have one of the worst congressmen who signed that pledge to Northbrook then, Joe Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and when their power is, they need so much money to come in these poor districts, fund the congressman candidates, the right-wing candidates they want, and get them elected. Because the people in this district don't have any money, don't have any jobs. And they're running right here hollering about the Chinese stole our jobs. That's a lie. They took them jobs to China for cheap wages. They took those $4 or $5 jobs out of South Carolina to China for cheap wages. The Chinese did not steal that. Those greedy folks who are pushing that same agenda that we see in practice today is the one who done that.
Okay. Thank you, Wilbur. Well, Wilbur sounds pretty angry, and it makes me wonder, Tim Dickinson, let's go to you, what kind of mood people are going to be in come November 2012? I'm asking you to predict a little, of course.
Well, I think John was exactly right to point to President Obama's strategy, which seems to be running against Congress, and I think Congress will probably return the favor. This I think advantages Republicans in some way because their brand is so anti-government, and so when government is as dysfunctional as it is right now, it sort of makes their case. And I think you're going to see a lot of throw the bums out this cycle, and that could hit some established incumbents, and it could also hit some Tea Party freshmen, frankly. But I think we're going to see a bunch of turnover in this election, perhaps at the top.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the Super Committee's failure to come up with a deal. We're speaking with John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and political writer for The New York Times, and with Tim Dickinson, political correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine and author of RollingStone.com's political blog, National Affairs Daily, and with Alex Brill, research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's a former senior advisor and chief economist to the House Ways and Means Committee under George W. Bush, and speaking to us from Washington. And as we did before, let's go to our website for a couple of comments. Here's one from Leatherstocking. Jackie, can you ask your guest to address the fact that the draconian cuts we face are not actually spending cuts, but rather reductions in the rate of increasing government spending? And also on Facebook, Debbie Blanton, I'm tired of the no taxes mantra. I think every congressman needs to take economy 101 again, and their benefits, including their nice comfy pensions, should be first on the chopping block. Where do we go from here? I don't know. Let's take a call from Chris, who's calling from Middlebury, Connecticut. Welcome to On Point, Chris.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it would be wonderful if we had some more input from the right. I mean, we're paying about $500 billion of interest every year right now, so our budget has to account for about $500 billion of interest. That means anybody who wants to build a factory in this country, for every employee he has, he's got to consider he's taking on a debt of old debt from past taxes that have been borrowed for, of about maybe $100,000 per person. If you took all the money from every wealthy person, all the income from all the wealthy people in the country, including the basketball players, your Hollywood stars, take all their money, sell their homes, take everything they've got, you still don't come close to making up the $1.5 trillion deficit spending Obama's doing every year, which means you still haven't solved the problem. And then what do you do next year? All the seed money for new businesses is gone. It's too expensive to do business in this country. The tax burden and the union burden is outrageous. I know, because I was put out of business by it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for those points, Chris. Alex Brill, how much is the deficit pulling down our economy?
I think that the role of the deficit on the economy comes in two pieces. In the short term, we're running a fiscal deficit on the federal level of over $1 trillion. In the long term, we see projections over the next decade potentially of $11 trillion deficit, and things get worse after that. This does have can have a significant impact on the economy in a couple ways. One, as the debt to GDP ratio, the share of our debt as a function of the size of our economy, rises, we start to get into very serious and potentially unsustainable territory. This is the crisis that we envision as a potential threat to our economy in the future, similar to what we've seen in Europe. Now, that's not a near-term threat. I don't mean to use a scare tactic here, but it is a real long-term challenge that our economy faces. In addition, in the near term, the fact that we are borrowing well beyond our means, and that we don't have in place any system for recouping those funds, where, in other words, the system is bad and scheduled to get worse, does create a sentiment among both consumers and employers that cause people to pause. And so we see when the economy is weak, we see people pulling back, holding back, and we see at the moment on the employer side and the investor side, businesses sitting on cash, waiting to see what changes are going to be made before they start making their own business investment decisions.
Tim Dickinson, do you agree with that? You know, Alex just mentioned sitting on cash. There was an interesting story in the New York Times today. As layoffs rise, stock buybacks consume cash. And about exactly that sort of thing, it singles out Pfizer in the lead of the story, laid off 1,100 employees, but not because the company was saving money. In fact, it was buying back its own stock. I mean, is the deficit, do you think, what is depressing jobs creation?
No, we have a problem of aggregate demand. Consumers don't have enough money in their pockets right now, and so there's a lot of money sitting out there on the supply side, thanks to a lot of supply-side tax cuts, that doesn't have any productive place to go in America right now, and that's because people really just don't have the spending money in their pockets to drive the economic growth. And so that's an economic problem that has suggests a role, at least in the short term, of government in helping people have more money in their pockets. And so, I'm not sure that I agree with Alex's assessment of sort of the root cause in this case.
All right, let's take another call. Carl is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to On Point, Carl.
Hi. I think that the Republicans are so hell-bent on destroying President Obama, they are so stubborn and so owned by Grover that they have failed to see the trap that President Obama has put them in. In the beginning, he wanted the grand bargain, which he knew they wasn't going to accept because they're beholden to Grover. They wasn't going to accept those taxes. So when they come up with the super-duper committee, he knew that that was going to fail because, again, they're beholden to Grover and no taxes. So now he gets to run as the responsible adult against the Republicans. He gets to run on Save the American Motor Industry. He gets to run on getting Bin Laden. He gets to run on a long range of different things in the country, health care. The only thing they get to run on, they get to run on three things against him. They get to run on the economy, which they share, and they get to run on Obamacare. And, man, the third thing, I can't remember.
You're having one of those Rick Perry moments, are you? Well, you know, I have to say, we all have had them from time to time. Carl, thank you so much for your call. John Harwood just makes me think. Can't wait to see the ads for next year. But isn't that the Harry Truman strategy, running against a do-nothing Congress? It worked for Harry Truman.
That's what he's going to try to do. It's more difficult, of course, because Democrats share governance in Congress because they control the Senate. But really the issue that the caller identified as the linchpin of the Republican strategy is the economy. That's what it's going to be about. And it's a very powerful issue. And it's why when I talk to Democratic pollsters, they think it's not much more than an even money bet that the president wins re-election, because presidents running in an economy this bad with voters feeling so negatively about Washington, the track record is not good. So he's going to have to be very aggressive and very effective in defining the problem as one that he can solve long-term, but for the resistance of Republicans to things that the American public agrees with.
And, of course, whoever takes the White House next year, the congressional makeup will determine whether or not progress is made on some of these issues we've been talking about.
Absolutely. And there's no guarantee about what the outcome of the Congress is going to be. As Tim mentioned a few moments ago, there are Tea Party members who are going to be swept out in the anti-Washington tide. There are Democratic senators who are likely to be swept out. We don't know whether Republicans are going to retake the Senate. That's more likely than that Democrats would retake the House, but none of those combinations is impossible. Probably the worst outcome for Republicans as a party would be to take everything, because then, as President Obama and the Democrats discovered in 2009, when you have full responsibility at a very difficult time economically, where there is weak consumer demand, where businesses are sitting on cash, where it's not clear how we recharge growth at the level we need to bring unemployment down, that's not an easy formula to take charge of.
All right. Let's take perhaps a few calls together to get more on here. Marcus is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Welcome to On Point, Marcus.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just had a quick question. You know, with the whole super committee and the Republicans talking about cutting entitlement programs, unemployment's at about, 10%, and we're seeing a lot of the baby boomer generation coming up on retirement, and a lot of them, from the middle and working class, Social Security is, their lifeline, what they rely on. So my question is, how are any of the Republican candidates for president going to look these baby boomers in the face and say, this is something that we're going to take away from you, even though it might be the only thing that you have coming into you whenever you're coming up on your retirement?
Okay.
And how to communicate that effectively.
All right. Thank you for that call, Marcus. And let's also go to Hannah, who's calling from New Ipswich, New Hampshire. Welcome to On Point, Hannah.
Yeah. Hi, Jackie. I have just a couple of comments. They're talking about entitlements, as your previous caller did. I don't see Social Security as an entitlement. We paid into Social Security. Our employer paid into Social Security. The people that have entitlements are the people in Washington. They get pension. Their families have the best health care that is paid by taxpayers. I don't understand why they want to cut entitlements.
Okay, Hannah, thank you very much. Well, a couple of calls there about entitlements. Alex, can we take the first caller's point? I mean, certainly, do you think that Democrats have put entitlements on the table, and are they going to get trimmed? I mean, certainly Republicans have taken a look at them. Earlier, John said that that was something that philosophically Republicans want to shrink.
I think it is true that Republicans in Congress, as well as the candidates on the campaign trail, do believe that those programs need significant change. But I think it's very important, and to be very clear, that that no policymaker on the left or the right is talking about making changes to current beneficiaries. So the types of reforms that we need in those systems, we need to put them in place today because we need to allow for future beneficiaries to recognize the changes in the systems that are necessary for the programs to remain sustainable. Absent changes, those programs are scheduled to go broke. So we need to address Social Security, we need to address Medicare, but we're not talking about taking someone who's turning 65 today and giving them less tomorrow.
We're getting a couple of calls about entitlements. Let's take another one. John is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to On Point, John.
Thank you, Jackie. I just wanted to ask a question about entitlement reforms. And from my understanding, the way it's set up is that money that goes into Social Security can be borrowed from the government for programs. And from my understanding, why is it that reform isn't being spoke about how we can set up a way to leave that money where it is at and not borrow against it, and therefore it'll be there, I guess. And I don't hear much reform about that at all. All I hear is we need to get rid of it. And I don't think that it's fair that we get rid of entitlement reform, that if I invested into something, I didn't ask for it to be borrowed against. I asked for it to be there when I retire. Is there any language about talking about reform that can help the government prevent from borrowing against what's supposed to be there when you retire?
Okay, John. Well, I think you did just hear Alex say that this isn't going to current beneficiaries. But that is another part of the debate here. Former Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson spoke before the Supercommittee on November 1st, and he criticized the AARP's ads lobbying against cuts to Social Security benefits.
And let's just look at the AARP. Just this morning, I saw that ad, the most disgusting ad I've ever seen. They said, we are 50 million, we're watching you, we remember, and we vote. I tell you, that is a really ugly thing. But let me tell you about the AARP. What will happen with their view of the world, which is to do nothing to restore the solvency of Social Security, in the year 2036, you're going to waddle up to the window and get a check for 23% less. And then I hope that they will remember the AARP. I certainly will, and a lot of young people will, too.
Tim Dickinson, are we kicking our problems down the road here?
Well, I think we need to look back and see how we got here. I mean, Ronald Reagan cut a deal with Tip O'Neill to create the Social Security surplus in the first place. And then the Bush tax cuts of 2001 and 2003, rather than lockboxing that surplus, rated it to pay for tax cuts that went primarily to the wealthy. And now, you know, the language of the GOP is that we need to reform these entitlements. Well, that means we need to cut them and scale them back and do away with as much of the New Deal as possible. But, oh, by the way, you know, America's older people, we're going to let you have the last bite of the apple. And you know, and it's not just me saying this. This is David Frum, former Bush speechwriter, member of the Bush administration, said, rather than workable solutions, my party is offering low taxes for the currently rich, high spending for the currently old, to be followed by who knows what and who the hell cares. This isn't conservatism. It's a going out of business sale for the baby boom generation. And I think that's an incredibly damning indictment from a former member of the Bush administration, prominent conservative who used to work at Alex's think tank.
John, we have not talked much about military or Pentagon reaction since yesterday. What about that? Is there a lot of concern that too much is going to be on the chopping block now from on the defense budget?
Yes, and you've heard Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, who's also a former budget director of the United States, say that those cuts go too deep. And I think there's a general expectation in Washington that the automatic cuts provided in the law that set up the supercommittee will never take effect. Now, the president said after the failure of the super committee that he would veto any attempt to legislatively undo the automatic cuts. But I think he does not mean if some other method of getting $1.2 trillion is derived, either by Congress next year or by Congress after the 2012 election, and that's what I would expect as well.
Very, very quickly, Alex Brill, are we going to look like Greece?
No, I don't think we will. I think that at some point, policymakers will come together, will recognize the need to start to make changes. I think we can make small changes, and we can make them frequently if the voters understand the importance of getting our fiscal house in order. We had an opportunity in the super committee, and we blew it, quite frankly. But that doesn't mean that there aren't chances to address these issues in the future.
All right. Well, I want to thank everyone for participating today. We've been speaking with Alex Brill. He's a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and he was also the former senior advisor and chief economist to the House Ways and Means Committee under George W. Bush. Thank you so much, Alex. And we've also been speaking with Tim Dickinson, who joined us from San Francisco. Tim Dickinson is a political correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine and author of RollingStone.com's political blog, National Affairs Daily. Thank you, Tim. And last but not least, John Harwood. He joined us from Washington, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and a political writer for The New York Times. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and you're listening to On Point.